Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the Commonwealth Club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Social Capital, Making Meaning Matter, led by Kevin Jones, who is the convener of the SOCAP Conference and the founder of Good Capital, Steve Wright of Grameen Foundation, Paula Goodman of Omidyar Network, and Greg Ulrich of Hope Consulting. This is our annual program as kind of a preview of the SOCAP Conference, SOCAP 2012, which will be happening in about a month. But with that, I would like to turn it over to Kevin Jones to kick things off and lead into our panel discussion tonight.
So, thank you. We're talking tonight about impact investing, social enterprise, and a new way of moving your money. Moving your money and investing for positive social impact and environmental impact, not just negative screens so you don't invest in tobacco, guns, other kinds of things, but a new way of moving your money. It's an asset class, and it's a lens on investing, and it's a movement. It's a messy space that is starting to become defined and starting to grow. And so we do a conference here in San Francisco called the SOCAP Conference, Social Capital Market. It's kind of a heretical mashup by intention. Social capital are those ties that you have with people, your family ties, et cetera, and capital markets. And we are a mashup of those two things. There's a reason that market comes together, and there's money around that market because they're investing in businesses with the positive purpose of doing good. So we call it the market at the intersection of money and meaning. We have a great panel tonight, some real experts with a diversion and a diverse perspective on this new thing. It's investing that's entering into the space where only giving used to go. So, Greg, you've done some research with Hope Consulting. Can you talk about what impact investing is and who's getting into it and why it matters?
Sure. Thanks. So one of the things that we've been doing is trying to understand what is the demand and interest in impact investing. And I'll get to how we've defined impact investing in just a little bit. But we want to understand, amongst individual investors, are people interested in this? Are they very interested, maybe on the fence? If they're interested, do they want to devote half their money to this, a small portion? Sort of what's out there and what are people interested in? And when we think about impact investing, we mean investments that have a proactive or an active goal of creating a positive social or environmental impact and also generate a financial return. Financial return need not be a market rate return, but some financial return. And what we found was that individual investors, people like all of us here in the room, have a bit of latent interest in these types of investments. We found almost half of individuals said that they're interested, and only about 15% were really closed off to the idea and had no interest in even exploring this with any of their capital. And so we found over $100 billion market opportunity for this, and we tried to understand what's holding people back. Why aren't people actually coming into this market? We found two interesting things. One, people get their advice and look for guidance on these things, especially in new opportunities, from their financial advisor. And secondly, they said, my financial advisor doesn't know anything about this. He's never talked to me about it. I believe if I spoke to him about it, he'd look at me like I had, you know, a tail, and I'm just not comfortable with the conversation. So we then looked to see, what about financial advisors? Do they have any interest? So we studied financial advisors, and we looked at about 4,000 individual investors for that piece of the study, and we looked at over 1,000 advisors. And by advisors, I mean your broker, your wealth manager, registered investment advisor down the street. And we found they actually, about 38%, to be precise, were very interested in this field. And over three out of every four were open to the idea. And they saw it as a real opportunity to differentiate themselves, build their business, because they believe that there are some clients that are interested in this. So when then we looked at the advisor side, we saw, okay, well, advisors are interested. And we said, well, do you ever talk to your clients about this? They said, no, our clients would never want us to talk about this. They'd look at me like I have a tail or something like that. So we see interest both on the advisor side, on the individual investor side, but there's not a lot of meeting about those in the middle. I guess I'll leave it at that and talk about what we can do to get those sides together, maybe with right. A later question.
So, but one of the questions is, why is there demand at all? Why it used to be that you would give for good, but you would give for good after you'd made money, and you would only give the money that is left over. So, Paula, from your perspective, why should you even invest for good? Why does this make sense? It when I started, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, it didn't make sense at all to people. They said, I have two pockets. I have one pocket that I put the money in and I invest and I put it away for myself. And then I have another pocket that just a little bit of money comes out of toward good. But they're totally different. Why would you even think about investing for good?
Yeah. I mean, I think and that pattern, you make money and then you give a little bit of away, is very deeply ingrained in Western culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Omidyar Network, where I work, was started in 2004 by Pierre Omidyar, who had started eBay, right? And he was really intent on breaking that pattern for a specific reason, right? So when eBay went public, he did what most wealthy people do, you know, when they want to give back to society, which he started a foundation. I mean, that's exactly this pattern. Let's give it away. And then he stopped and thought about it and thought about the kind of good that markets on their own can create that you can't necessarily tap into with grant money, right? So eBay itself, for example, was started with $10,000 of startup capital and ultimately created 1 million jobs, many of whom went to sort of disadvantaged populations. And so he dissolved the foundation and created a Omidyar Network with this explicit desire to tap into the power of markets to solve problems that you might not otherwise be able to solve. So let me give you an example. We made an investment recently in a group called Bridge International Academies, which is a very low-cost private school chain that works in very poor populations in Kenya, right? It charges parents $4 a month to send their kids to school, which is the same amount of money that you would otherwise spend in kind of like paying bribes to teachers and whatnot in the public schools, and for that very, very high-quality education that's kind of off the charts. The reason why this model is working is it sort of demonstrates the power of tapping into markets, right? Number one, if you're charging money for a product, you better ensure that that product is going to be of high quality, right? So service delivery, the quality of the delivery of the product is an advantage that markets have, right? And then the second one is scale. And this is incredibly important, right? So if you are charging money for your product, you are reinvesting that money in the business and growing the business, you might even eventually be able to tap commercial capital, you're going to be able to scale a lot more quickly to serve millions of people. And hence, you know, I think that what's so exciting about impact investing is being able to, you know, use those kinds of tools to solve social problems that we might not otherwise be able to solve. Not a silver bullet, not appropriate for all problems, but very, very exciting.
Right. And I'm not sure who can best answer this, but Greg or Paula, I think, but why is it hard for people to think about investing that way? What you're breaking down the Western model of I invest for financial return, I give for good. What makes it? What makes what Pierre did and what the demand? You know, when I started out, it was a really hard idea and it was hard to get through. And now there's a lot of demand. What's happening that people are getting this? Greg, let's start.
Yeah.
What is it that people are asking for? What's the demand?
Well,
what's changing?
I think we have a growing generation, a growing movement, that people realize we have important social problems in the world and we're looking for ways to solve them. And there has been a traditional way that's very ingrained between you invest on one side and you give on the other. And I actually think it's going to be very slow to break that mold. And that's one of the reasons, one of the challenges for the impact investing market is this is a cultural belief that we hold that you should make as much money as you can, invest it to make as much money as you can, and then give it away. As most people that sort of have a career, I think, between age 20 and 40 that has some sort of social impact, they've probably had a parent or guardian say, why are you doing that? You could make more money doing something else and then give that money away later in life. And it's a mindset that I think is starting to change. But one of the things we found that was interesting in our research when we were looking at the demand for impact investing is there was a concern that this was going to be a cannibalization to philanthropic giving. So Americans give, individuals give about $215 billion a year to charities, and people said, well, people start investing for impact, and especially if these are below market rate of returns, that's going to cannibalize charitable giving. And when we studied these 4,000 individuals, people don't see them in the same camp. We actually had a study that had half on charitable giving, half on impact investing, and people, all the money they think about putting into impact investing, over 90%, comes from their investments, money they would make in the future, discretionary spending, other places, and just a small sliver, less than 10%, would come from charitable giving. They don't see it as that pile. That there's this
so it's not reducing
belief.
The money that they
no,
give.
No, we don't think there's going to be a significant cannibalization.
This is new money coming in.
But I do hope that the world becomes less binary between you can give money to charity or you can make as much money as you possibly can. I think there's a great opportunity in between to use your investments to have a positive good.
Yeah. And Steve, from your perspective, you work in the nonprofit world, Grameen Foundation. What's the risk of this thing? I mean, is this an answer, or what could go wrong? What troubles you as you see investors come into a space where nonprofits used to work?
Yeah. So it's a good thing. Period. It's a good thing. People should be thinking about the impact of their money. I think we hopefully are emerging from a period where we have conceptualized business as amoral. We've conceptualized what our money does as amoral, right? I'm going to put – and that's this investment pocket. I'm going to put it over here and I'm going to get as much as I can back. And we in our investment, just as the corporations do, push the cost that ends up in the commons, the cost that's off the books – the cost of industrialization and all this kind of stuff. We push that cost out of our minds. And then we go over to impact investing and we say, okay, now I want to try and do something good, right? One of the things that impact investing has to wrestle with, in my mind, is that it has taken the investment paradigm, which is essentially amoral or structured without morality, and it has to apply a morality to it. Equity and morals matter, and they matter to all of us in a very, very real way. And so if what impact investing does, if all that it does is take the horsepower that is the market and capitalism and puts it over here, it's not going to work. And we're going to see the same damage that was done in microfinance. And you can also look at the successes and who survived in microfinance. What are the most effective microfinance organizations today? It is those that paid attention to the value to the end constituent. That's what actually matters. The return that comes from investment in a social context is realized by the commons. The social good is not realized by the investor.
Mm-hmm. So I followed a pretty good bit of that. If you could clarify that, when you say it's not going to work, when you say just applying the amoral tool of the market to the world of doing good, why isn't it going to work?
Well, so it's not going to work from the perspective of solving massive global problems. Mm-hmm. It might work from the perspective of making people some money. Mm-hmm. Certainly for a while it will. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw what happened with when organic and greenness showed up, and then you get greenwashing right mm-hmm. afterwards, mm-hmm. right? So this is the exact same danger that we have here. If investors don't attach themselves to the social good that is intended to be created by their investment, then we run the danger of turning impact investment into marketing and PR.
We run the danger of turning impact investing into a market.
Into marketing,
PR and PR and marketing.
Exactly.
So when you say tie it to the social good cause, the good is in the commons, can you explain what you mean by that?
So the Bridge Schools, which is a fantastic organization, it must matter that children are being educated. Mm-hmm. It must be actually important that poverty is being alleviated. Mm-hmm. These things are valuable, right? It doesn't mean it's a dollar in my pocket, mm-hmm. but it does matter. It's almost more that the investor in that context is a customer than they are an investor.
You're a customer of who?
Of Bridge Schools.
They're a customer of Bridge Schools, and Bridge Schools has kind of been hired to produce the good that
Absolutely.
Bridge Schools is doing.
Yes.
And so is metrics and measurement all you need to do then? You say, well, we're creating that much good, we can see it. Does that solve the problem?
No, but okay. It's something you have to do.
You have to do that. What else do you have to do?
You have to count.
Yeah? What else do you have to do?
Well, you have to count, and then you have to have powerful theories of change at the social enterprise level. So in the same context with at the impact or at the investment level, where we're saying that we can't just take the mechanism because it will leak into the impact. It's at the same thing at the social enterprise, right? So the social means something. A social enterprise are social maximizers, not profit maximizers. Mm-hmm. They're actually profit minimizers.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean impact investors should be willing to make less money?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Definitively.
They should be willing. Is that always true?
You know, I'm not sure that, well, okay. I think so impact investment is actually a disruptive innovation. And that market rate, when we're talking about 16 or 30% or these just ridiculous numbers, those are numbers that are not accounting for reality or actual cost that's being pushed off in a pie that no longer can continue to expand.
What is the interest
rate? Of what?
Of social capital. Give us a number. Give us a rate.
Usually the top is 6%.
And a lot of the stuff is equity, and that question applies to some situations and not others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
We'll open up to questions and things later. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Okay. So, Paula, I'll start with you, Greg.
Yeah.
The investors who are wanting this, are they expecting market rate? Are they expecting to make as much money doing good as they make from a traditional investment when they step into it?
Yes and no. Okay. So I think the challenge is there's a lack of clarity in the market. And the problem is, and I promise I'll directly answer your question, but everything's lumped together. So, and I'm not entirely sure who we have in the audience. I'm going to ask for just a quick, raise your hand if you've heard there's a $3 trillion social responsible investing market. Has anybody heard that? Okay, so.
Half a dozen hands raised.
Yeah, so there's a broad market that people talk about social investing. And it's much broader than below market rate impact investing. That is sort of a subset on an extreme. And there's interest in that. People are willing to make below market rate impact investments. People are also willing to make market rate impact investments. And people are willing to make sort of market rate investments in more publicly traded securities that actually have liquidity and can be traded on a market. And there's a great demand for that. The problem we have, I feel, and what most investors feel and what most advisors feel is everything's lumped together. And what that does is it makes, you know, when something that's below market rate return and should be below market rate return, and if it's 6%, if it's 2%, but if it's a great investment that's having a meaningful impact on people and has a terrific social impact, when that's trying to be lumped together with the market rate of return, it hurts everybody. Because they're trying to prove there's something that they're not. And then the people that are actually only interested in market rate return investments look at these other things that clearly can't generate those kind of returns, say, this whole market is full of crap because they say they're going to produce one thing, but the financial returns can't possibly get there. I think what we need is clarity. And when you get the clarity, you'll find that people are willing to invest a small portion of their income in below market rate returns. But a small percentage of millions of people adds up very quickly. And we find, you know, almost $100 billion market of people that, you know, are willing to consider putting their money in things that have rates of return, but might not be 12%, but might be 4%. And they're willing to put a percent of their money in there, just like Americans give 2 to 2.5% of their money to charity. We find people are willing to look at the idea of putting 1 to 2% of their money in below market rate return investments across population large, obviously, there are peaks and valleys. But.
Paula, Omidyar was one of the first to look at this middle space between giving, where 100% of the money goes away, and you want market rate to do good, which means you don't want to sacrifice any financial return for the good you do. You save the world at no discount to financial return. And it was hard to get there. I mean, there is maybe some more understanding now that you can be in this middle space, but what is it hard for people to get that? Why is it hard for people to say, I'm investing and it's going to cost me something?
Yeah. Well, so let me try to address that. So I think, you know, there was a comment earlier that there's a danger with impact investing that it's just going to be marketing.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree with that, but I would put a totally different spin on that mm-hmm. in answer to your question, right?
Okay.
So we've been doing impact investing since 2004. The phrase itself got coined in 2008, and we were thrilled. We were like, oh, now we have a name to
right.
talk about what we're doing. And all of a sudden, we saw tons of investors come in and say, this is so great. I can make money and do good at the same time. This is totally fantastic. Show me the investments. Guess what? You know, like there's so first of all, there's a lot of good that capital markets already do on their own, right? So if there is a market rate of return to be made, we're pretty sure that the traditional capital markets are, you know, that move $300 trillion a year or whatever money or whatever sum that is, they're probably going to take care of it, right? So if we're talking about new things, new innovations that cause social good and can also be profitable, then we're wondering, where is this deal flow going to come from? And when we stopped to question ourselves, we realized it's great to focus on market rates of return, but we're also going to need to be more flexible if we're going to get in there and do the early stage work of getting these new innovations to scale up to the point that they can get commercial capital.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to beg to differ, which was said before about the role of commercial capital. Commercial capital is incredibly important, right? Microfinance, wouldn't have been able to reach hundreds of millions of people without commercial capital in play, right? But what's missing, so commercial capital enables scale. If you want to solve a social problem at scale, that's sort of the whole promise. What's missing right now in the impact investing markets are people willing to do earlier stage and take greater risks.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to make one really important clarification there. That doesn't necessarily mean that you can't get market rates of return. Sometimes it means, like in the case of Bridge International Academy, it's the low-cost private school chain, right? Sometimes it means that you're just going to get to know these markets better and have a different interpretation of risk than traditional investors, right? So traditional investors are going to look at Bridge Academies, which serves the slums of Kenya, and say, whoa, that's just totally ridiculous. We're not going to get the rates of return we want, right? But we would
look at
it and
say, neighborhoods. They won't go there.
Yeah. But we would look at it and say, we know this market really well. We know this entrepreneur really well. We know this team really well. We've done all this diligence. We think we have some specialized knowledge there. And, you know, we went in and we went in with people that were mostly philanthropic-oriented investors in the beginning. And as they proved their model and scaled to a number of schools and children, we're starting to see commercial capital come in,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is sort of the fundamental promise of impact investing, which is to say we're gonna take these things that other people say are risky and we're going to de-risk the generic model so that it can become profitable, right?
But that's just better research, knowing. It's kind of like, you know, that's where Warren Buffett goes. He finds undervalued assets and has some understanding of the market.
So that's part of it,
that's
right?
Part of it.
And then
yeah.
there are circumstances where there's a trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be a subsidy, you know. So if you're dealing, the poorer the population, the more the market failures that exist. So, you know, sometimes in the slums of Kenya, you don't need to take a trade-off. Sometimes you do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think.
Can you talk about an example of an investment where, you're making less money because of who you're serving? Tell me about that company and then the decisions around that.
Yeah. So another recent investment that we made was in an organization called Anudeep, which Anudeep operates in India, and it fundamentally exists to employ poor people in kind of outsourcing operations for sort of technical tasks, right? And
so they have to have a laptop somewhere in a room full of computers in a cyber cafe, or what happens?
Yeah, I mean, I think a variety of equipment that they use, not necessarily a laptop, but essentially, you know, we looked at this model and we ended up breaking it up into two different entities, right? And so they employ poor people for, you know, they have an outsourcing center, and then they also train people with technical skills. And we realized that that training itself was going to need a subsidy. So we gave a grant to the training center, and we made a for-profit investment in the outsourcing center. And, you know, and we looked at that and we said, that's fine, because if they can prove the model, if they can prove over time that that this population, which is not seen by most of the outsourcing industry as a viable source of talent, if they can prove that this is a viable source of talent, then in time other people are going to find more profitable models here, and this will be scalable.
So you're wanting to prove that the model exists, and you're willing to take that risk and do the subsidy.
Right, and that's exactly what happened with microfinance, right? Mm-hmm. So microfinance, you know, in the beginning, the idea that small loans could be made to poor people was laughed at, right? By, you know, if you took that to Citibank 40 years ago, right? And so it was a lot of subsidized capital in the beginning for decades until then it became break even. Then it became very low profit for profits. And finally you started to see Citibank get into the picture, right, when it became very profitable.
Right, right. Steve, does that make sense to you? Go ahead.
It does. So, the statement that commercial capital enables scale is 100% absolutely true, but what does it scale? Right. In what we saw in microfinance was that commercial capital enables profit-focused microfinance organizations to scale. It does not necessarily, and the word necessarily is important, it does not necessarily enable value-focused microfinance organizations to scale. When you look at the studies, David Rudman's book and others, due diligence, What you see is that a lot of the commercial capital railed against subsidy before it was even willing to come in big numbers into microfinance, against subsidy, which was what we use, was what was used to build the market, exactly what Paul is talking about. But they said it distorts the market. And then commercial capital came in and said, we demand these market rates. And many microfinance organizations failed their customers, their clients, the poor people, because they had a profit-based bottom line.
Can I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Counterpoint that for a second,
sure.
Because I think there's a lot of. I mean, this is an ongoing debate, and it's a very difficult one. And I think we as an industry need to look at what happened with microfinance. And for those of you who are in the room who are not familiar with what happened, but there was a sort of a crisis recently, a couple of years ago in India, where. There was an accusation that the rates of interest that were being charged to poor people were way too much, right? And just a whole political crisis occurred because of that. But if you look comparatively across countries where microfinance scaled, and you look at what was the single biggest enabler of lower rates of interest to poor people that were borrowing, it wasn't regulations that said, hey, you need to cap the rate.
Absolutely.
Or people voluntarily saying, you know, we're gonna make less profit. It was countries where regulators enabled competition, right? Regulators enabled fierce competition so that the rates went down and became reasonable, right? So then going back to this question of whether or not commercial capital is going to enable responsible scale, I agree that we need to be very, very careful about it. But I think the answer is more in appropriate regulation and having those very important conversations with policymakers early on to make sure that consumer protection is built into these industries and less about restricting the scale of the industry.
Right.
totally agreed. I think that's dead on accurate. And
so if you do it right, it can work.
Yeah.
And if you subsidize at the right level, it can work. You can take less money and do a lot of good. You can prove a model. how do we get more people to do it? How do we grow it? If we say this is a good thing, it's got the risk, you know, you have things where it can blow up, how do we grow it? Paula, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to say something that I think he'll disagree with. But,
sure.
So,
I do that a lot. Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's a lot of talk, right, you know, for the first few years when the term impact investing coined was like, look, there's, you know, trillions of dollars in the commercial markets. Let's just get them to be more interested in impact investing. And I have just gone through a defense of commercial capital, obviously I think that's very important. But I don't think that that's where the deal flow is going to come from, right? So right now we have a deal flow problem. We can't find enough really solid deals that have both financial return and social return. And what we think is really going to grow the market so that commercial capital can find enough deals is getting people to go in earlier stage. So getting more sort of angel and venture capitalists to take an impact investing approach and take the risks, you know, get their hands dirty, get to know markets. And this is something that's very difficult, frankly, to do from San Francisco, if you're talking about rural India, which is why it requires building local teams, which is something we really prioritize, getting to know the markets and willing to, you know, getting willing to take risks that other people won't take.
So, willingness to take a risk. Greg, what do you think will take it to grow?
I think it requires clarity, awareness, and more information. And by clarity, I mean just, you know, I talked before, there is demand for people to go into below market rate returns. There's a much greater demand for people to go into market rate returns. Right now, it's muddled. It's difficult for an investor to understand what the opportunities are, and we need to build more clarity around this market and what the investments are aiming to do. And we need to build awareness about some of the opportunities. And individuals, advisors have a lack of information. They don't know where to go, where to get information, what are the anticipated financial returns, and what are possibly the social returns from these investments. Until we kind of can build that information, which I think the GIN is doing a great job of, and Impact Assets is doing a great job of, many other intermediaries are starting to really do a good job of, it's going to be difficult to build this market. And then the final thing is, I do think while there's demand for some of these below market rate returns, there is significant more demand for people to make investments in things that the average investor can invest in, publicly traded debt, publicly traded equity. And when we can find those investments that have positive ESG and not just the negative screen stuff that Kevin mentioned before, I'm not just talking about things that take out tobacco, but people that are doing a good job of screening these things for best-in-class environmental, social policies, governance policies, there's a lot of demand there that's untapped. And when we can get people involved there, we can get advisors to recommend those, we can get investors into those, and we see that when people start investing in those types of investments, they're much more likely to then take the step to say, okay, this is a little, I'm starting to understand this is a little less risky. Now I'm more willing to accept some of these more risky or lower rate of return investments. And there's almost kind of a gateway effect there.
Steve, if we want to grow this thing and do it in a way that's good, how do we grow it?
So I think, number one, there's no silver bullet. There's no quick fix. I think jumping to commercial capital, and I think we've gotten in a weird discussion about commercial capital here, but we're not going to go down that any further. jumping to like this magical pool of big money that'll make everything okay, it's not going to happen. The money must stay attached to the social outcomes and not the financial outcomes, or at very least in addition to the financial outcomes. We can't wave our hands at the social outcomes. And part of what that means is that investors have to start to think about how they can realize benefit to the commons, because it's not going to be money in their pocket. We have to figure out how we are an ecosystem, how we are, and how an economy is humanity, and how these things can intersect. It's cultural, and I think that was your point earlier, is that there's a cultural element to this. We won't get there until we feel the pain that'll push us there.
Right. And so Greg has said that we need more information. Paul is talking about, you're talking about taking more risk. More risk means you don't know. When you go into these early stage deals, You know, Jay Kimmelman at Bridge Academy, I met him before he had done any investment when he was in an apartment on the Panhandle. And he's one of these remarkable entrepreneurs that, you know, the guy in his apartment with the two-page plan turns out to be what he's doing 8 years later. It's pretty unusual. You don't usually find, you know, a guy in an apartment who's come up with an idea. It becomes that. So you're taking a risk on character. If doing the risky stuff and being willing to fail is what's going to start this market, how do you start changing the attitudes of those investors who will start doing the risky things that then can result in the things that the financial advisors will invest in later?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is talking about which audiences or sort of which group of actors is
exactly
appropriate for what part of the food chain.
Right.
So my mom and dad are in the audience. Like, I probably wouldn't have used their money to invest in Bridge, although looking back, I might. They might be happy if I had done so.
Yeah.
But we live in Silicon Valley. We live in a place where there are a lot of people who understand entrepreneurial risk taking, who are angel investors. We have, you know, we understand what venture capital is, right? And there's a lot of people who have made their money and are looking to do good and can say, hey, look, you know, this old model where I just have to give it away is no longer the only model.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are the people that have the ability to step in at the earliest stages and take the greatest risks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the risk thing is absolutely critical in here. And your point about who's the audience that's taking the risk is instrumental in growing this market, because your mother and father, my mother and father, and people in general, When we ask, you know, what matters to you in these types of investments, what do you care about? The social impact obviously rises to the top. The other thing that rises to the top is risk. Return does not. This is not, you know, looking at impact investing, people are not worried about 12 versus 9% returns. They're worried about 9 versus negative 100% returns. That is, and there are ways we can structure these investments that we can put the risk on the parties more willing to take on that risk and take it off of the people less willing to take on that risk. And the example that comes up a lot is the Calvert Community Investment Note. It's been around, and anybody know how long that's been around? 20 years? For
yeah.
15 years?
Yeah,
and,
not that long.
But it has over $200 million invested in it, and they haven't, you know, no investors lost money investing in this note, and it's addressing community development, people that are having a terrific social impact. And the way it's done is because they have support and they have capital that can take a different level of risk than the individual investor. So you take it as a fixed term, fixed price loan, 2% over 4 years, and you're not experiencing the downside. Now, could you do better than 2% return for the terms? Yes, you could. It's below market rate, but you're not exposing the individual investor to all the downside risk. They're being protected. And I think as we can start to put different types of capital that can take different levels of risk and stagger that so the individual can maybe not experience the upside but be protected from the downside, it's going to be critical to growing.
With the Calvert note, with MicroPlace, with no interest things like Kiva or Ventana for education, the average person can get involved in this kind of thing.
Yeah, the average person.
Why aren't there more things? You know, the Calvert investment note is the example, and then there's the Calvert investment note. what's up with that?
So this is not my area of expertise, but they're regulatory issues. It's difficult to structure products that have these types of structures for retail investors and not have them only for the accredited investors that can take on these types of risk. A lot of these are private equity, private debt securities that you're trying to translate into a format that can be taken by retail investors.
It's complicated, hard. They're the ones that do it. So let's go down the line. One last thing. Why does this matter? And if it works, what good could it do? Start with Steve, but ask the same question. Why does this matter? And if it works, what good could it really do?
Yeah. So I'm kind of the curmudgeon here, I guess, a little bit. But I believe in market forces, and I think of the market like physics, right? These are rules. I think we lay ideologies on top of the market, and then things get all kinds of weird. The market is by far the most powerful engine that we have today to solve the world's most intractable problems. This is a way to do it. The differences you're hearing between us are differences of practitioners. We need more people focused on using this engine to solve our problems.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I mean, you have trillions of dollars at play. Small changes in that can have big impacts. And we have 300 billion going to philanthropy. And if you look at the total revenue of nonprofits in the U.S., it's about 1.4 trillion. You look at the total invested assets of money managers, it's, I think, 27 trillion. We're just looking at a much different pot. And as people's perceptions are changing, I think as we can continue to change the way we can use that money for good, we can have tremendous positive impacts. The way I've always internalized is thinking actually of a foundation that has $1 billion in capital. And if they're giving out their grants each year, they're giving away 5%, they're giving away $50 million. What are they doing with the $1 trillion, right? I mean, what about that $1 trillion? Where is that money being invested? What's the impact that can have there? And think about the scale. That's 20x what they're giving away. You don't need to have the same level of impact, frankly. There are other ways to think about using that capital to solve our problems. And we need to unleash more money to solve these problems because they're not going away and they're critical to our society.
Yep. Yeah, I think you have us all agreeing.
It's amazing. I think so.
I would echo both of those comments, and I would also just note, we got a lot of problems out there to solve, and our track record at solving them is really not that great, right?
And there's not enough money in philanthropy
exactly,
to solve the problems.
Right. So why wouldn't we? Why wouldn't we try this?
Right.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay, we've reached the point in our program now where we're going to turn it over to the audience for audience questions. I would like to tell our audience listening at home tonight, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight, Social Capital, Making Meaning Matter. Our panelists are Kevin Jones, convener of SOCAP and founder of Good Capital, Steve Wright from the Grameen Foundation, Paula Goldman from the Amityar Network, and Greg Ulrich from Hope Consulting. I'm Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. I would like to turn it over to our panelists now, and Elizabeth has the microphone for questions. But so I wanted to ask one question. So if you're just an individual, either an individual that has some money to invest or an individual that wants to make a difference maybe in speaking to foundations or making your voice heard, where can an individual start here and not feel overwhelmed with the big money guys?
I think you should definitely talk to your advisor and ensure that they know that this kind of thing matters to you.
I agree. And if you're the position I am and didn't have a financial advisor, the two things. One, there's a great, not to pitch a firm that I'm not related, I have no conflict of interest here, but Veris Wealth Partners is here in the city. They're a financial advisor that has a terrific terrific knowledge of this space, and they also have a website that helps break it out for you a little bit. And then in terms of resources, if you just want to actually go learn and find a place to go learn, I'd go to GIIN, GIIN.org. They probably have the best centralized resources to explain the space and what are some of the opportunities and give nice sort of profiles of different types of investments to really help you understand it.
And I would say two things. I mean, some of the things that individuals can do were already mentioned, like Calvert Note and whatnot. There's also some sort of angel circles you could get involved with, like Investor Circle and Tonic. And I would also say, Omidyar Network, we really actually care a lot about the opinions of individuals and kind of the opinions of everyone in this field. And one thing I wanted to flag was, we have a blog series coming out 2 weeks from today on the Stanford Social Innovation Review that talks about kind of the state of the impact investing market and what's needed to actually bring it to scale. And we would really welcome, I mean this for real, like we are open sourcing our knowledge process because we really want to be informed by the opinions of the community and would really value your feedback, your debate, your pushback, et cetera.
And I would also say SOCAP coming up October 1st through 4th out at Forest Mason. We've more than 1,000 attendees so far registrants, and we're about a month or 3 weeks out. But I think you'll see the people doing it. You'll see the entrepreneurs doing this stuff, and you'll see the investors doing it, and you'll see the people talking about how to make it go further. So, you know, it's a global gathering. We had people from 70 countries last year come to SOCAP, 1,500 people. So I think, you know, if you want to see what it's like, come out to Fort Mason 1st of October.
Okay, an audience question now, please.
I want to thank you for this panel and for the great work that you're doing moving social enterprise and the funding forward. My concern is actually that what's happening in public equity has been misrepresented here. I will own that I work at an asset manager. We have $1.6 billion of the $3 trillion you referenced. Mm-hmm. And my job is actually to use the rights that come with investor ownership and to push for positive social environmental changes at those companies. So we're working with large multinational companies like Target, Procter & Gamble, Novartis, and we're talking to them about those issues of concern, and we're using our voice as investors to get them to change their policies. It's not screening. Mm-hmm. It's more active
sure.
engagement. And what
yes.
I love what you guys are doing, absolutely, but I think we're doing a disservice if we say that there's nothing happening yeah. with large
absolutely.
Multinational corporates.
Sure.
Well
sure.
Fair enough.
And there are folks who are doing shareholder advocacy like you are that really matter.
And that's where most of the money is and where the money can come into because it's people can get into it.
Sure. And please make sure you do speak into the mic for your question.
Good evening. My name is Carla Mays. We have been working on the Social Innovators and Investors resource that aims to be the first foundation center for social innovation, entrepreneurship, and impact funding, building that ecosystem. And one of the questions that I have for you is really building this ecosystem strong. And how do we be able to work with Omidyar and those of you on stage to build this ecosystem where we're getting ground-up innovation and working to create a seamless deal flow between investor and entrepreneur?
It's a good question. There are a lot of folks trying to make sense of this and trying to bring the entrepreneurs to the investors. And you know, in one respect, the entrepreneurs need to figure out to invest also in making the entrepreneurs better, to making them more investable, capacity kinds of stuff. There are things like accelerators and seed funds. We have one called Hub Ventures that we do at the Hub, 5th and Mission. But there's Unreasonable Institute, there's DOSRA, there's Echoing Green, there's Village Capital. So I think, you know, the quality of the entrepreneurs needs to get better. And people need to invest in those things, and because investing at that early stage doesn't pay off, it'll have to be subsidized. None of those accelerators are money makers. So that's one answer.
Hi, I just want to say there's been some conversation tonight about marketing and how there's the potential for social investing to be marketed in a way that kind of renders it meaningless, as has been done sometimes with organic, for example, right, where things are labeled organic, whether or not they really comply with what individuals think of as organic. And I would like to ask, you know, I think as a Bay Area native, San Francisco native, and a marketer, I think that many of my peers, including myself, self-market. We think that we need to justify our own kind of wealth accumulation and so forth by social investing, without any real understanding of how we measure that impact. So we understand dollar returns. We don't understand social returns. There's no way to gauge it. There's no way to kind of have a quick, easy way in our busy lives to get if we're making an impact. And so it ends up being potentially relatively meaningless or relatively powerful, but we don't really have a good sense of that. Without tons of individual independent research and so forth. And I want to understand how we move it so that we're not just social investing in a way that is you know, potentially fake, right? It's potentially, you know, not doing what we want it to be doing, but is actually real. Because I think that if you couple minor returns in financial dollars with major returns and social returns that we can actually grab and get, then there will be a lot more power behind that movement. And for me, it's very amorphous. You know, I give money to Doctors Without Borders. How much of that is going to administrative costs? I think this is actually an issue in the philanthropic movement as well, right? But so I'm just curious, how do you actually measure change in a way that is understandable for people, like the average person that's doing the investment?
Steve, do you want to start with that one?
Sure. So this is where the center of a lot of my career has been, and what brought me to impact investing was an effort to get the money to be asking for the same things so that those entrepreneurs on the ground knew what to produce in the terms of stuff you could count. The state of the art, absolute state of the art for understanding impact is what's called outputs, counting stuff, pounds of food delivered, number of people vaccinated, students educated. That's the state of the art. When we talk about impact, lives change, quality of life, there's a lot that there's a lot of wonderful narratives, and they need to be written. The stories must be told because it does happen. But if you want numbers, it's outputs. It's the stuff that you can count. A wonderful resource, you can get to it via Gin, is IRIS. IRIS is a database of stuff to count. Everybody who's doing this work should be using those definitions. Then hopefully we can at least all be counting the same stuff.
Well, and then we need philanthropy to count the same stuff.
Yep.
And that's where your point is not an impact investing point. It's a social point.
Yep,
it
right.
It is more troublesome, I think, right. In philanthropy, because fortunately impact investing is new, so they could create IRIS. And they're like, oh, maybe we should start off with figuring out what we want to count. And philanthropy has been around forever, and you know, we have all these other cultural issues there and entrenched behaviors, and it's difficult to build that infrastructure.
But yeah. I would add two things. One, the IRIS database, which measures outputs, significant step forward, right? Because when you're measuring outputs, at least you can say, well, I've got two companies. One of them, you know, employed 10,000 people, and one of them employed 50,000 people, right? So at least you can start making those kinds of comparisons. The second thing I would say, too, is that while I will not pretend that this is not a gargantuan task for the industry, we sometimes forget that there was a time in history when we didn't have standardized accounting in terms of reference for commercial, you know, companies, right? And now we do. So it's possible.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Sudeep Motupalli Rao, beautiful communities here in San Francisco. There are two points I just wanted to ask about. One is we're always comparing impact investing returns with the market rate. And somehow, to me, the market rate doesn't really factor in the externalities that, for example, you see in coal and nuclear power. They don't factor in the externalities there. So similarly, is there any effort in actually discounting? Like if you're getting 20%, you're getting 20% because we're not factoring in the other things, like let's say gold mining in Canada or something like that. So that's just one question. Is there any major effort to actually recalibrate that market rate returns just so that we can look better in terms of... The second thing is, how do we get more of these impact investors to come and invest in Bayview Hunters Point and West Oakland? And if they are happening, who are those people? Because we would love to have impact investors. Yes, it's great to have Kenya and India, but there's a lot of work to be done here. So thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I can jump in on the second of those questions. There is a lot of impact investing work that's being done in inner city United States. I mean, we do a lot of stuff, for example, on financial inclusion for the underbanked in the U.S., right, for people that don't have bank accounts. And a shocking number of Americans don't have access to traditional bank accounts. You know, Pacific Community Ventures here, for example, in San Francisco does a lot of stuff. So I think I may have given the wrong impression because a lot of the examples that I used were developing country, but there's a lot of stuff going on here as well.
Yeah, the Grameen Bank just opened a branch in Oakland. And I think your point on the externalities issue is huge. When we think about what has to happen next, we have to develop an ecosystem where we're balancing true cost and true benefit. And in that context, what we are doing becomes a disruptive innovation and not an asset class. And that's what's really interesting.
Hi, my name is Gabrielle Durana, and I'm a social entrepreneur in education. My question is about the choice of a for-profit or hybrid or a non-profit model. I started an organization, and for moral reasons, I decided it had to be a non-profit because I believe that you should not make any profit on education. You must have earned income or some kind of viable business model. But for me, with my beliefs as a Westerner, coming from Europe at least, I believe that you should not be making any profit on education. So how do you actually handle the the fact that for certain areas, maybe profit is not something that should be sought at all.
Well, you have a firm belief. That is your belief. That doesn't mean that that's accurate. I guess that's one answer to that. But the other thing is there for certain people, that is the answer. But then you won't be able to attract capital and to grow what you're doing because people won't get their money back. You will get donations. You won't get investment. So, you know, it's a choice.
There's a wonderful book by Deborah Satz called Some Things Should Not Be For Sale. So this is not a comment explicitly on education, but it is a comment that book complexifies that issue very, very well. And I think it's an outstanding read. And the other thing is profit is a word, right? And it just depends on how you define it and what its color is for you, right? So profit can be thought of as cost, right? So it's the money that you get back and you reinvest could be profit, right? So you have to think about how your organization is using money. The fact that you are earning revenue on a service that you provide, that's agnostic, right? But what are you thinking is profit that you're adding a morality to is the trick.
So my question is to Paula and the panel in general. You mentioned that, you know, deal flow is a big problem and there's a need to increase deal flow. With the exception of, you know, having every single impact investor go into a country and actually set up an entity that actually knows this market, are there other ways in which you can actually increase deal flow without every single entity having to set up their own subsidiary in every single country that you want to invest in?
I suppose my answer to your question would be not everybody has to do this. I think there's a role for people that come in the later stage in the development of these industries and don't need to take these risks. But I would be lying if I said, go ahead, stay in San Francisco and make a lot of investments in rural Zambia without understanding the market. Like, I just don't think that that's solid investment advice, right?
The question is, does every single impact investor need to do that, or okay?
No, I mean, so if you, as long as you've got a solid kind of entrepreneurial ecosystem going in rural Zambia, and you've got kind of a few solid investors willing to take those early stage and venture, you know, those venture type risks, then, you know, 5 years later when that sector matures, whatever, say it's mobile money or something like that, you can sit here in San Francisco and make some investments. But you do really need to start at the local level.
I think there's something to be said for local money versus remote money, too, and we haven't really talked about that, but getting indigenous investors is a big issue in this space.
We have another question over here.
Hello, my name is Gina Maria Mele. I want to thank everyone here for coming this evening. This is a very important topic to be discussing. I was curious, you spoke a little bit about some of the challenges that this industry is experiencing currently. If you could name some additional limiting beliefs or limiting mindsets specifically about this industry being more effective or growing larger, I'd love to hear those.
So,
no, go ahead.
One thing that we're acutely aware of is related to something we talked about before, which is how we measure social impact, right? So right now we measure social impact at the output of individual firms. You know, I'm a mobile payments platform, and I got 100,000 people to make some sort of transaction on my platform. What that does not take into account is where that mobile payments company might be in the trajectory of the industry itself, right? So it could be, for example, that you're a very early entrant into the mobile payments industry in Bangladesh, and the market just is really, really tough. And there's not a lot of suppliers of phones, or that people really distrust the product, and the regulations are really bad. And you may not yourself end up making a lot of profit. But by testing the model and creating a demonstration effect, there might be in 5 years other people, other firms that come in based on what you've learned and make a lot of money, right? And then if you're a traditional venture capitalist, you're going to wait until this stuff is de-risked to get into the market. But if what you're trying to do is create you're an impact investor, you're trying to create an industry with massive social impact, you want to spark the innovation from the very beginning. And the problem is we have no way with our social impact measurements today to measure that sort of industry-level contribution to impact. Mm-hmm. So that's one mindset shift that we think needs to change.
And going back to the other question about do you need to be in Zambia to know those things, I mean, that is where there is this flood of venture funds who are investing who have the knowledge of Zambia. You can invest in those funds. You know, professional folks who know, like the Kibera slum where outside Nairobi, where Bridge Academy started. You know, you can go along in with those folks, or you can invest in those funds. That's another way. But going to the mindset around it, I think for a lot of people, they still are two-pocket thinkers. That a lot of people are starting to get the idea of impact, and there is this demand, but there is still an old way of thinking that I invest for financial return and I give for good. So I think that old way of thinking, that traditional way of thinking that probably foundations are stuck in more than most individuals, is one thing that needs to change.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where we have time for only one more question. I would like to let our audience listening at home tonight know that this is Social Capital, Making Meaning Matter. Our panelists, Kevin Jones, Steve Wright, Paula Goodman, and Greg Ulrich. I'm going to turn it over to an audience member for our last question, and then I'm going to ask the panel to make a closing statement.
Hi, my name is Bill Wilkie, and I have a comment that I invite your comment upon. And early in the discussion, the dynamic between amorality, morality, and marketing came up. And there was, if I have this correctly, there was the concern that if we don't migrate towards morality in our discussion of this topic, that we could repeat the sins of the past and devolve into marketing. And I think if we go down in a layer of complexity below that, and we look at both sides of that, on the morality question, the issue is, well, whose morality and what morality and what is the source of that morality? and on the other side, which is, it's a question that's been with us ever since the Middle Ages introduced diversity into morality, after the Middle Ages. And then, but on the other side is marketing, in which case, ineffective, evil marketing is manipulative. But effective marketing can actually be based in real insights and real truths. So I just wanted to serve up, there's a word that actually was in the title of this conversation, which is the reason I came tonight, is the word meaning. Because I think the word meaning can bridge the gap between morality, because morality is a subset of meaning. And it can also reach out to marketing, because in effect, marketing is nothing more than an attempt to understand and influence the narratives in which we live. So I just wanted to serve up the idea of meaning, the core word of this panel discussion, as a bridge between morality and marketing, as a way to ensure that we don't repeat the sins and mistakes of the past. I just want to invite your comments, if any of that was clear.
What do you mean? Let's close with... Let's take that, and I'm going to suggest that we take that, and we say why this matters, why there is meaning here, why this is not just investing, not just business, why it matters. I think for me, it is a way to put more power to do good than any other way, and I think it using the market in this way, and it's what makes sense to me, and it makes my life make sense when I look at doing this kind of stuff. So.
I suppose I would say that, we're in the very early days of a big shift in the way that we're thinking about how to create social change, and it's messy. But the promise is tremendous, right? We're talking about, and think about some of our investees, like D-Light, which does solar lanterns for, people living without electricity. And I think about the promise of scaling an entire solar lantern industry so that people, kids can study at night. Hundreds of millions of kids who can't study at night, right? Can we change that with the speed that we have never been able to accomplish before with just grant dollars alone? And I think that's the promise that we're looking towards. And there's a lot of messiness to get through to get there, but that's sure motivating to me.
Yeah. And I think as we move through that messy terrain, what's really useful to think about, I think the point made earlier about, like, let's not discount all this great money or great work that's being done by the capital markets that are not on the pure market subsidy, below market rate of return impact side. there's a tremendous amount of meaning in that work, and there's a tremendous amount of good that can happen there, and there's a tremendous amount of money that can flow into those types of investments. And I think if we can start thinking about those markets and start thinking about the impact investing markets and start drawing the lines between them so we understand what we're trying to do, where impact really needs to lead, and where we might not need that dichotomy as clearly as we might need it on the far end of the impact space, we'll be able to unleash a lot more capital, both from individuals, from high net worth individuals, from foundations, and through the markets overall.
So first of all, a mea culpa for, I think it was I that put marketing out as an evil. It's not. When I think about the work that I do, essentially it is sales and marketing. So powerful, powerful tools that we need to get the word out and do the work that we're doing. To the morality question, it's an interesting one for me. If morality is a tough word, then use justice and equity. If those are tough words, then maybe you're equivocating. There is stuff that's bad and there's stuff that's good, and we can work on that, the ones we agree on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, any last words from one of our panelists before we... Kevin, would you like to give us one... You're the guy that started getting this out to the whole world. Maybe you could just give us a couple of words of wisdom to live by.
There's more people doing this now. It makes sense to more people. The message is growing, the meme is growing, and it's amazing that there's less resistance. It's amazing that, you know, there's $120 billion in demand for this stuff. And, you know, I think we're riding a wave, and I think there's something real here. And I think as we hold fast to really being able to show the outputs, the number of jobs produced, the number of lives saved, the number of babies who survive, who are low birth weight because they have an embrace incubator around them in places mm-hmm. where they don't have those mm-hmm. kinds of things. As long as you can point to the good that you're doing, I don't think we will go into just greenwashing. So I think it's real and it's big and it's growing, and I think the chances are we can make it stay real.
Greg, go ahead.
And we talked a little bit about the two pocket, you know, make money in one pocket, give it away in the other, and how we're moving away from that. And just we don't need to move completely away from that.
Yes,
with all your money immediately.
Right, exactly.
And
sure.
That I think that is where that's one of the risks is, oh, if you're not doing this with all your capital or you're not completely committed to this, you're not in it. Well, I care a lot about philanthropy. I don't give away all my money. I don't give away as much money as I possibly could. I don't go as far as the giving pledge, and I haven't signed up to give away half my wealth. I think we can think about those analogies in the sustainable and the impact investing space. There are ways to experiment with this, to get in with a small portion of your dollars and see how it works and find some of the opportunities on the private side, on the public side, on the community investment note side to do some of this. There are ways to get in this where you can really limit your downside, have a lot of good, and not feel like a whole 180-degree mindset change has to happen before you start putting your money to have more meaning.
Greg, any last comment from you? Any last comment from you? Last statement?
There is one real quick one, and that is that I was I may have sounded like I was bashing microfinance earlier. Being the guy from Grameen, that's a little weird. Microfinance, and I have seen it firsthand, when it is value-focused and looking at the outcomes and the quality of life for the poor, it's absolutely transformational, stunning, stunning business model. It can be profitable and effective. It continues to serve as an example of how this can be done well.
Thanks, Greg. Paula, one last comment?
It's my second last comment. I love it. You know what? I just want to thank you guys for a great panel. I already made my last comment, so thank you.
Okay, well, that's a great way to end, and thank you all.
Good job. Thank you all for coming.
Our program tonight has been Social Capital, Making Meaning Matter, here at the Commonwealth Club of California. Our panelists, Kevin Jones, Steve Wright, Paula Goodman, and Greg Ulrich. With this, I would like to adjourn this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'd like to thank our audience here, our audience listening at home. This is the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion. This meeting is adjourned.
I like the formal...